I'm James Devine, and I'm your host for today. Welcome to the second episode of our Human Element in Healthcare podcast, brought to you by KPMG, where we will explore a range of issues which impact the workforce and patients in healthcare organisations. Our aim throughout this series is to help healthcare organisations to understand how, through an ecosystem of approaches, we can empower, enable, and engage the workforce to deliver better citizen-centric services. In today's episode, we'll be looking at the elements of recruitment and retention and how this has evolved in light of the pandemic and what needs to be in place to secure workforce for now, the future, and importantly, existing talent to stay in the health and care sector. Today, we're joined by the fantastic Elizabeth Niyawadeep, or Liz to her friends, Chief People Officer at Surrey and Sussex Healthcare NHS Trust. She's here to share her experience and insights over what's been a career spanning 20 years in the NHS, and in the private and voluntary sector. When Liz isn't working, I know she's a big Formula One fan, and she also enjoys running and cooking, and I can vouch for her cooking, having tasted it. It's very, very good. So Liz, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much, James. I'm delighted to be here.
Excellent. Good. Really looking forward to talking to you over the next 25 minutes or so. But I know that you really get the challenges around recruitment and retention across health and care, but in particular in the NHS, given your role in Surrey and Sussex. But let's start with kind of the obvious question, I guess, when it comes to recruitment, and we talk about the growing vacancy challenge. So talk to us just a little bit about your experience and what you think might need to happen to kind of shake up and modernise the approach to recruitment in the NHS.
Drawing back from my experience, looking at the last sort of 12 months, 18 months, we are seeing an increasing number of vacancies across the NHS, and in particular in the organizations where I work in. And some of the things we perhaps could do to address this includes reviewing our recruitment process within the NHS. Over the years, we traditionally use systems and platforms such as NHS Jobs that could be long-winded and take a lot of time, and some candidates are well put off by the long processes we use in recruiting staff. So that is one of the things we can change to help us attract and recruit candidates faster into the NHS. A number of things are also coming to the fore when you talk to candidates, and that includes things like flexible working. They want to see jobs that offer them opportunities to explore other interests other than just work. So those two stand out for me looking back over the last sort of 12, 18 months in terms of some of the things we could do urgently to improve the recruitment of staff into the NHS.
Yeah, one of the things that we often hear about, you know, from doing lots of work with health clients, and you'll understand this, is that there's lots of competition for jobs in different industries, and mm-hmm. we often hear sort of anecdotally that people leave the NHS and many of them, you know, go and work in supermarkets or Amazon and various other sort of anecdotal feedback. And it's interesting you touched on application form. And if you kind of imagine yourself as a 20-year-old Liz Niyawadi wanting to get into the NHS, and your first step is a 26-page application form.
Yeah.
What needs to change there? Because it's, you know, I appreciate, you know, all the benefits of platforms like NHS Jobs, but there's got to be a modern way, hasn't there, that gets people not having to print stuff off at home and the like. So what, other than the kind of couple of things that you just talked about, what do you think is the big thing that would kind of really shake up recruitment in the NHS?
A really, really sleek, short process of attracting the candidates, interviewing them and getting them into the organization, and reviewing what we can do after the candidates have already arrived and are working within the organization, instead of putting out all that information for them to provide to us before they get into the organization. I think a sleeker process. We could also do away with some of the information we ask for, supporting statements that run into 1,500 words. We could just make some of that information shorter and sleeker to get our candidates in and just look look at what can be done, what is really, really needed, what needs to be done later on, and just get them quick, attract them, and within a week, 2 weeks, turn it around and get those candidates with an offer letter knowing they're coming into the organization.
So a bit like a Lewis Hamilton pit stop.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. When we get to that stage, we shall have nailed it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, some of the work that you've been doing, you know, successfully, you know, over a number of years, but sort of more latterly in your current role is around sort of international recruitment. So we know from, you know, various sort of data sources over the last year or so that, you know, the impact of international recruitment in nursing has been, you know, largely positive. But actually, you, the NHS has done that for such a long time, and that there you know, inevitably will come a point where, you know, international recruitment might not be the kind of core answer. And we saw that, didn't we, through the pandemic when international recruitment sort of ground to a halt. So there's a big sort of risk factor there. And it'd just be interesting to understand, you know, what mitigation steps are in place around international recruitment. But I guess more importantly, you how or what are we doing across the NHS to ensure that we are keeping up with the demand? So are we training enough nurses to cope with the demand in 5 years' time, for example? Talk to us a little bit about all of kind of the international recruitment, the risks, and whether we're doing enough to secure the demand.
So international recruitment has been a really good pipeline to fill our Band 5 nursing vacancies. And in fact, it's been the most reliable pipeline to fill up the vacancies at that level. If I look at our local recruitment, we have struggled with local recruitment of getting nurses at that entry level point at Band 5. So we've ended up over the last 2 or 3 or 4 years just being totally dependent on international recruitment. When we talk about growing our own, and are we looking within, are we looking locally or within the country in terms of the future pipeline for the nurses, a number of things come into play. We've got the great apprenticeship route. However, as we all know, it doesn't always come with the backfill money required to ensure that we can successfully commit to those routes, given the challenging financial climate we work in. We also know that some of those really, really attractive new roles that were created, I'm talking about the nursing associate's role. Previously, when it kicked in, it was supported by some funding from Health Educational England. We are seeing that in the last year or so, that money will no longer be available to support growing our nursing associate's route. So that poses a financial challenge as well. We need to also increase and really ensure that the work placements we offer to student nurses who are currently in existing educational institutions, we need to offer them extremely good work experience within our organization so that we can lure them back to come and fill those posts when they complete their training. I'm not sure we've cracked it yet in terms of a reliable grow your own route with locally, but it is one thing we continue working on and hoping that we can secure a reliable source going forward. If you ask me what my dream sort of vision would be around this, it would be working really closely with the students coming out of the education system early on at that 18 years old, 17 years old, try to target them and work with them and really sell working in the NHS from way back when they're still in primary education, so that for those who do not continue on into higher education facilities, we bring them into the NHS, we deliberately nurture them and start developing them into different healthcare roles, including helping assistants, and finally work with them to growing them to become registered nurses. These will be people who are local to their institutions. They are very familiar with the cost of living in their local geography. And this will also help us address some of those obligations we have as an anchor institutions to our local geographies. And with that comes, you know, addressing maybe health inequalities in the future. If we nurture people, give them jobs, they have an income, they can look after themselves better. That would be my dream goal when we get there.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a big agenda, isn't it? The kind of recruitment and retention. And you touched on a couple of points there about apprenticeships and kind of role redesign, basically, things like the nursing associate. And we've done, you know, lots of work with, you know, national bodies and local trusts on, you know, what could role redesign look like, and, you know, things like physician associate and anaesthetic associate. But it'd be useful or really helpful, actually, to understand, you know, what level of autonomy do you have? So you talked about there not being backfill money, so therefore that's a restriction. So you know, as I say, I've known you a long time, and you know, formidable Liz Niyawadi, breaking down those barriers that, you know, some people might struggle to get over. So where does that line kind of start and stop when it comes to the autonomy that you might have to think, actually, I need to be quite creative here about role redesign? Because I'm, you know, let's be frank, if you've got hundreds of nurse vacancies and a turnover rate, you're going to be constantly recruiting nurses just to keep up with baseline numbers. So what autonomy do you have, or what autonomy would you need perhaps to just get going on some of this stuff?
Well, I guess in my role, there's that duty and responsibility to influence and make sure that the growing our own nurses or growing our own workforce in different roles remains on the radar of the board, of my fellow executive directors, is constantly championing that and putting it on the agenda as an issue that we need to deal with, that as an issue that we need to address. So it will be more about influencing locally and understanding the environment within which we work in and taking those opportunities as they arise to constantly call out perhaps a different design, role design to help secure the workforce for the future. Outside our local organization, it's about linking in with the current setup that we have in the NHS, which is, you know, talking to our system partners, talking to our regional partners, for them to help influence right up to the national level, NHS England, to see how we can maybe work with educational institutions to develop those new roles, design new roles and provide for the required learning so that we can get a different set, different roles to come out of the educational institutions in the future to come and work in the NHS. So it's not a one-man agenda. It's about influencing locally, working with the system partners, working with regional teams, working with the national teams, who in turn would influence the educational institutions and together collectively design different roles for the future to come and work in the NHS.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think something that we you talk about a lot is a statement that Jeremy Hunt made when he was Health and Select Care Committee chair. And what he said was, you know, paraphrasing, but he said, you know, nobody on the front line knows whether we're training enough people to cope with demand over the next 5 or 10 years. And it sometimes feels like you HR professionals are focusing on the here and now for all good reason, and, you know, providing safe care with you know, the right numbers of people. But actually it's quite difficult then, isn't it, to take yourself out of the here and now and think 3, 5, 10 years down the line, what can I do today to make sure services are safe in 5 and 10 years time? And I think, you know, one of those big issues, you know, you can kind of plug the front end in the way that you talked about, but actually, you know, perhaps a bigger concern is about retention. You know, we know there's been, you know, lots of changes over the last, you know, couple of years about pension reform and you know, people leaving post pandemic and doing other things with their life, which you can completely understand given what I know has been a really, you know, difficult time for lots of health and care staff. But what are you doing? And, you know, go back to your, you know, my dream would be, what would the dream be when you look at retention in the NHS?
Right. Retention is a completely different game now in the NHS. If I look back at what we are doing now and the focus we have to give it now compared to 5, 10 years ago, It's been very much influenced by, of course, a new generation coming into the workforce and with a very different mindset. This new generation are people who do not live to work, they work to live. And they have a completely different agenda from what we had in my generation years ago. These are people who almost dictate what they want out of the workplace. And we've got to work with that. We've got to roll on with that if we're going to retain our workforce. Lifestyle choices is big, and it's most of our workforce would prefer that to just having a job to their name. They wouldn't hesitate to leave you to go to a competitor who will offer them maybe lifestyle choices. Flexible working is absolutely big for colleagues at the moment. And I don't know whether it's been further exacerbated by the pandemic we had, where people sat and reviewed their lives and their priorities, but flexible working is big. And we need to wake up and realize that within the NHS, we run for 24/7. And we've got to start thinking of maybe somebody coming and starting a shift at 10 o'clock at night and going home at 6 o'clock in the morning, as opposed to saying, we don't have a shift like that. We've got to move with the times, because to some people, that is when they want to work. And if you can offer me that, yes, I'll jump and work for you. Mm-hmm. If you can't offer me that, I'll go and do something else because it fits in better with our lives. So the game of retention has completely changed. It's more about us working with the market to see what we can offer them that fits and suits them, as opposed to the traditional, we can only give you this, take it or leave it, and they are leaving it big time and going. Yeah. The other thing that I've noticed that is helping us a lot with focus on retention is focus on the person. Well-being is big for our colleagues at the moment. And strangely, and this one completely surprised me, at interviews, we have candidates asking us about our green agenda. People have cottoned on to those climate change. Are we a green employer? Can we demonstrate that we are doing things to support the green agenda? That one completely surprised me. Yeah. But such is the group we are getting in, the caliber of candidates we are getting in. And we need to work with those things that will appeal to them to keep them, to help them stay in the workforce.
Yeah. I think the stuff on retention is really critical. And I think, you know, I've seen some really good examples of quite innovative practices. Mm-hmm. You know, one trust recruited, when they recruited a consultant, mm-hmm. they automatically offered their spouse or partner a wow. role in the organization, provided they met, you know, criteria mm-hmm. and there was a vacancy, etc. But they made a commitment to recruiting okay. you know, the family, knowing that the mm-hmm. family would be in some cases relocating.
Yeah.
But there are some good examples. And you know, one HR director joked last week that we should offer, you know, as an option, you know, a 12-month Nando's subscription. You know, so but you know, as flippant as it sounds, and there are yeah. other, you know, chicken shops available, but yeah. as flippant as it sounds, mm. you know, it goes back to your point about mm. putting the person in the centre yeah. of mm. recruitment and retention. And of course, you need to retain the people that are coming in, but we also need to retain the existing talent and experience that we have. So you, I say, as different as it sounds, but what would be your view if you said, you know, to your board, look, you know, here's some innovative practices about attraction, recruitment and retention, including things like you know, chicken shop discounts and, you know, various things like that. Is that something that, you know, you would ever think through as a potential recruitment and retention plan?
Of course, James, the door is open for anything we can do to retain our staff. But I think one thing that I'd really love to do, and I do think about it a lot, is offering all our staff 24/7 free hot meals. I was reading an article on Twitter. I love Twitter. I get so much information out of Twitter about this NHS organization where they have started offering their staff breakfast. Now, people are getting breakfast when they come into work. If we look at the times we are living in, the high cost of living is a real challenge at the moment for our colleagues across the organization. And doing things like that, a free hot meal or free breakfast to all our staff, sends a message that we care. We are thinking of you, we are thinking of your welfare, and we want the very best of you. It also sends a message that we acknowledge the current challenging environment that we are living in. So doing things like that for staff go a long way, and people will remember that. And that sometimes goes a long way to retain our staff, because it speaks to a lot more than just, we want you to come here and do the work, work, work. It's also about, we really care about you as a person. And yeah, we are here to look after you as best as we can.
Yeah, no, completely. And as I said at the outset, you've always been a very, very strong advocate for people, well-being. And well-being, extends beyond basic kind of benefits. You get lots of trust of good counselling and therapy through occupational health, and those sorts of things, which some people don't always think that they can access or don't want to access. So there's got to be other ways that kind of manage the whole wellbeing agenda, including things like what keeps people in the organisation. You touched a little bit there on kind of interview questions that surprise you, like the kind of green agenda.
Really
important. Probably haven't got time to sort of talk through that today, but what would be your sort of top tips? So you've been in the HR game a long time. So what would be your sort of couple of tips around retention that you think, just stop for a second, forget the kind of should of, would of, could of. What should we be doing today across health and care to keep the existing experienced, talented individuals that we've got working across the health and care sector?
Listen to our staff. They will tell you what matters to them, and then work with what matters to them to retain them.
Good advice, Liz. Thank you. I want to just kind of move into something else that you touched on there when we talk about apprenticeships and kind of learning, and how do we facilitate tangibly that change from where we're at today in terms of recruitment and retention, and where we need to be over the next 3 to 5 years or so. And one of those things is about apprenticeships. We know that in kind of medium-sized trusts, the apprenticeship levy is kind of close to £1 million. So it's a sizable amount of money. What are we not doing that we ought to be doing to support recruitment and retention? And I'll sort of give you a few seconds to kind of think about it. And I'll tell you that we've done lots of work at KPMG. And as you know, I've done lots of work in the NHS previously on attraction, recruitment, retention. Some really, really effective, and some things just don't work. And sometimes you've got to just kick the idea to the curb and move on to the next one. So how do you kind of triangulate these three things, right? So staff survey results, retention and turnover data, and then the local labour market. How do you pull those kind of three strands together and think, I'm going to develop a really strong recruitment and retention plan? How do you do that?
At the moment, James, we pull out the data. Of course, data is useful in informing you what the reality is on the ground. And at present, given the challenges we are facing as NHS organisations, and I'm touching on financial challenges here, the approach we are taking is working in partnership with different organisations locally around us, working in partnerships to see what we can do, how we can share resources to develop our colleagues, if it's a development opportunity, let's say if it's perhaps a training opportunity. It's about finding out different colleagues from different organisations coming together either to fund it, and that way one partner doesn't bear the costs of all the funding, and opening up the learning to different colleagues in different NHS setups, or even just us across the system working together to pool our resources, to share our knowledge, to offer developmental opportunities across our various organizations in the system to help us just manage some of those challenges, whilst also improving, developing our staff, and in so doing, retaining them. So that partnership working has opened a completely new route in these tough times to help us retain our staff by those opportunities. I'll give you an example of what I mean here. We work with the local NHS community organization and rotate our staff across the two organizations, giving them an experience in a community setting and an experience also in an acute setting. And that has just opened up a new world for them in terms of growing their CVs, what they can quote, learning and developing. We are also sharing that now with a local hospice where we do training together for their staff, our staff, and we also send our staff to work in their setting. It's a new experience for our staff and a new way of learning. They feel they're benefiting, growing their CVs and their careers, and that way it helps us to retain them. We just have to look at those creative ways of sharing resources and working together to retain our staff.
Yeah, I agree. That's a really kind of innovative kind of approach to work sort of across organizations. Sometimes we get hindered, don't we, by the barrier walls of our hospital or our part of the health and care system. Well, actually, you know, there is no reason why we can't sort of kick down some of those barriers and start thinking about roles that span across the spectrum of health and care services. So it's great to hear some of the stuff that you're doing there. Do you think that we're sort of doing enough within HR to expedite digital solutions? So we've talked, I know you and I have talked before about recruitment and about whether it's quick enough. But actually part of that is about removing duplication, isn't it? And having things that are automated. Yeah. So do you think we're fast enough? And if I give you an example, if I'd said to you 5 years ago across the NHS, we're going to roll out MS Teams in about 3 months and every single day, everyone would do exactly what you've just done and said that's not possible. But actually, can we expedite digital solutions to support HR practice?
We can. And in my view, we are not doing enough. And I was thinking about this. Digital literacy is not an area we focus on across the NHS. People fear anything to do with digital until they've been there, done it, touched it, are so used to it, and it becomes the norm. I don't think we invest enough time to train our staff or just to expose them to the digital platforms we have, but we could do so much more. I'll use my own example. I had one of the sort of external supplier ring me to say, hey, there's a new way of doing recruitment, and it's a bit like a dating website where you go on, you put in your job, you advertise your job, and then candidates are also on this platform, and it could be a match. When they see your job, they like it, you've got a match, like you do on a dating website. And I immediately thought about, oops, what is this? Oh, how can I expose my staff to this? Is this real? How does it work? It took a lot of convincing, but it is one I'm going to try very soon. And when I get there, I will share with you my experience of recruiting on this digital platform where you get a match.
Yeah, no, I like it. I like the idea of that. Yeah. So listen, for those listening, if you ever get the chance to hear Liz speak at events, particularly where she's sharing her actually very amazing and inspiring career journey, absolutely do that, because I've been in awe of that journey for many years, although I know you were always reluctant to talk about it, which you are doing more of more latterly. Mm-hmm. But my question, I guess, on the back of that is, what makes Liz stay in the NHS?
The difference we make to our population, our patients, day in, day out. I think about that, and I also think of the fact that today I'm sitting here comfortably at my desk. Tomorrow I could be the patient on that ward, and I'd want the very best from the people looking after me. So that keeps me going in the NHS.
Listen, we've got time for one final question, Liz. So what are the one or two kind of key questions that healthcare leaders should be asking themselves to improve, you know, onboarding, recruitment and retention to secure existing and future talent? What would be those kind of two things that you would be urging fellow HR professionals to focus on?
The future is digital. We've got to do something different and embrace digital platforms, digital ways of working, because that is the future. And the second thing is we need to focus on the people and go by what our people are telling us, what the candidates are telling us, because the world has changed and it's out there. You know, it's all about the candidates now and not so much about the employers.
Yeah, there's probably a question in there about whether we do enough to capture the experience of candidates going through a recruitment kind of process, or whether we ask enough directed questions about, you know, what makes you stay here. It's something worth considering. But listen, we are out of time. But listen, it's always great talking to you, and I thank you for being part of this podcast. We've certainly covered a lot of ground, so thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your kind of two or three key takeaways. I think mine would be that, you know, digital literacy is definitely something that I think we need to reflect on, isn't it? Having those more innovative solutions in the way that you talked about, you know, sharing, you know, staff effectively across organizations and moving people and resource around to where the need is. And then be brave, I guess, is something that I know you are, and I know that you would encourage others to be brave and fail fast and move on. But yeah, listen, I could talk to you for a lot longer, but I want to thank you again for being part of the podcast. It's always brilliant talking to you.
Thank you very much, James.
We have many more guests in future episodes who are passionate as much as Liz about delving deeper into the current workforce challenges. So please do subscribe to our podcast to get alerted when new episodes are published. But for now, thank you and goodbye.